This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. It may be the 100th anniversary of Fenway today, but it's also the weekly anniversary of our Week in Review. So here we go.
We'll be talking about new efforts that encourage Massachusetts doctors to apologize for medical mistakes, and about rising tensions in communities vying for casinos, and about following the stimulus money and finding out where it really went. And to help us do all that is Peter Canellos, editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. Welcome back, Peter.
Thank you, Meghna.
Also with us today is Jack Sullivan, senior investigative reporter for Commonwealth Magazine. Jack, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much, Meghna.
All right, well, let's start with casinos and rising tensions in a couple key communities here in Massachusetts. Here's how the Sun Chronicle characterized this week in Foxborough. Quote, "The venomous casino contest hit a new extreme." Well, just how extreme? Here's how Fox News describes it.
He wants a casino in Foxborough so badly that he allegedly made death threats to get one. The contentious fight taking a new turn today. That man accused of threatening a town selectman who opposes the plan.
Well, another casino opponent, he didn't receive death threats, but town manager Kevin Pecos says he believes a majority of the overall selectman's board is going to move to fire him because he says he's standing up for a town called Foxborough, not Craftville. Peter Canellos, let's start with you. What do you make of the deep emotion and rising tensions in Foxborough?
Well, we heard during the debate over whether to legalize gambling that this is kind of what happens when the casino industry moves in. You've got a situation where people can make a lot of money through these casinos, but there's a very difficult permitting process through all these different government agencies. And yes, when there's a big fortune to be made, or people think there's a big fortune to be made, there's going to be a lot of strong-arming tactics. And so it's not a surprise, but it's unfortunate to kind of watch it unfolding.
Jack Sullivan, your thoughts?
I tend to agree with Peter. There's nothing gentle or genteel about the industry itself, so it does trigger high emotions. I think you're also seeing that within the Wampanoag tribes as well. There's
a battle.
Right, well, not just in Taunton. I mean, you've got the Aquina out in the Vineyard, who have recognition but no land, they have land but no recognition. The Wampanoags, who have recognition but no land, and then Pocasset, who's got neither, but they're going for both. So, there's definitely going to be a battle there as well.
Well, so on that note, I mean, the group that has all the attention put on it, because they're the ones who are going to have to sort all this out, is the State Gaming Commission. And this week, Commissioner John McHugh said they've been inundated with questions from cities and towns, beyond the ones we were just talking about. Here's a little bit of tape from Mr. McHugh at a meeting that they had just this week.
And by the types of questions that they're asking, perhaps assign priorities to the kind of policy decisions we make so that we can keep up with them and with others in the field who are struggling with these difficult issues.
Peter Canellos, difficult issues seems to be a very gentle way of putting it, but we have this combination, you were hinting at it before, between the polarization of the issue and now a very complex bureaucratic process, don't we?
It is, and there's also no established kind of standards for people to judge these decisions. So is the Gaming Commission supposed to look at the needs of the individual small town, which might be quite different from the statewide needs? So, for example, for a lot of statewide reasons, it might make sense to have a casino in Foxborough instead of one in Boston, because in Boston, there's more gambling, potential for gambling addiction, there's more potential for traffic, there's all kinds of other factors that are in play. Yet, is that the standard on which the Gaming Commission is going to make the decision, or is it going to be how much support is there in Foxborough? How will the town be supported or victimized in this instance? It's just a very, very tough issue to parse out.
Jack Sullivan, this is exactly the kind of issue that I know Commonwealth Magazine does a great job following on. So, I mean, Peter brings up this interesting question of the competing interests here. What's your take on that?
Well, I think one of the things that happened with the way that they laid out the legislation is they've actually pitted people against each other. It's it's been legislated to pit people against each other. And when you've got regions that stretch from Boston up to the New Hampshire main line and then out as far as the furthest western points of Worcester County being one region, you're going to have a lot of competing interests. And one of the things that's happening, I mean, all the focus right now is on either Suffolk Downs or Foxborough, and people tend to forget there's some big money going into Milford and Marlborough proposals as well, and they're going to be competing in that same region.
Well, on to another story from this week, and this actually has to do with something you reported in Commonwealth Magazine, Jack, and that has to do with the $16 billion that the state of Massachusetts received as part of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, a.k.a. the stimulus. You start with the story of a $30 million footbridge as an example of, well, maybe how the money might not have been put to best possible use. Tell us about this bridge first. Well,
it's a 700-foot footbridge going from Paul Revere Park in Charlestown over to North Point Park over in East Cambridge. And it's a beautifully designed bridge. If you go over there and look at it, it's sweeping and it undulates as it goes across the Miller River, but it's 700 feet. And it costs $30 billion.
$30 million.
$30 billion. Yes, yeah, I'm sorry. My B's and M's mixed up. And it comes out to be about $43,000 a foot. I mean, that's some serious money. The interesting thing about it is this same design, this same bridge, was presented to the Big Dig back in the beginning of the 21st century as part of a mitigation deal. And it was dismissed then by the Big Dig because it was so expensive. Same bridge, same design. The money is there, so they were able to build it because it was shovel-ready.
So is this an example of a project? Oh, it was shovel-ready. Okay, but I think you found that the majority of the stimulus money wasn't actually spent on brick-and-mortar projects.
Not the traditional way that we see it. In Massachusetts, $2.1 billion of the contract grant and award money, which is about $7.9 billion, was spent on research and development. That's an enormous amount. The average around the country is about 4.5% of whatever the state took in. In addition to that, that's like 27% of the money that we got for those type of projects. That's about 18% of the total amount of research and development dollars that the federal government handed out. So we got the lion's share of that. One of the issues with research and development is clearly we are a knowledge-based economy, and that's one of the ways that we're so far ahead of a lot of other people, but it doesn't create those bricks and mortar jobs here.
Mm-hmm. Peter, what do you make of that? Because I recall hearing Governor Patrick say, you know, repeatedly that absolutely some of the stimulus dollars that he knew were going to spend to save jobs, for example, that already existed. And as Jack's pointing out, you know, one of the strengths of the Massachusetts economy is in things like R&D. So does it sound like it was money well spent or not?
It does sound like it was well spent. I mean, first of all, the R&D dollars were not divided equally among states, so we were in a position to get more money than other states. So the fact that we're spending more proportionally on that is good news for us. I mean, I think Jack correctly points out that it means that we did really, really well as a state, but that some people did better than others. But that's not the fault of the state. It's the fault of the federal program. And it's not even the fault of the federal program because we all believe that R&D dollars in medicine is a really good thing. So, yes, a lot of money was spent to save jobs, just basic state jobs, teachers, firefighters, police, all of that. There was a lot in the stimulus bill that saved those jobs, federal government giving money to the state of Massachusetts to make those bills. And and then the R&D money on top of that, that's great. So I think that, you know, people should be supportive of the stimulus bill. It did a lot of good.
Jack, is that your takeaway from your reporting?
It is to an extent. I mean, I agree with Peter that, you know, it's a very good thing to put it in because that's what our economy is. But I'm not sure that people fully understood that that's how the stimulus money was going to be spent. You know, when you think stimulus, you think bricks and mortar. You think the projects. And Governor Patrick said recently that there were 90,000 stimulus-related jobs. Well, the problem with those figures is that includes everything from one-hour paycheck over one quarter up to full-time jobs. Nobody has a real handle on it, and one of the things that I found in my reporting is best estimate it was about 10,000 full-time equivalency jobs were created in Massachusetts, But again, they were stimulus-based, so there's no guarantee that they're going to last beyond the stimulus money.
Well, anyone who's interested in reading more of what Jack Sullivan reported, I'm sure we have a link to it at radioboston.org. But before we run out of too much time, I want to talk about the last story of this week, and that is a new program called Disclosure, Apology, and Offer. And it's what seven area hospitals, including Massachusetts General and Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, have decided to do regarding encouraging doctors and nurses to apologize when making medical mistakes. There's a lot of reasons for doing this, and one of them is there seems to be ample evidence that by saying sorry, it cuts malpractice litigation. So, Peter, your first thoughts on disclosure, apology, and offer.
It's a very good idea because in the past, medical professionals did not apologize because they feared that it would be used against them in lawsuits. So this essentially gives them an incentive to do so. And I think a lot of the people who sued were suing because they felt like they not only were mistreated, but they ran up against this wall of silence at the hospital or this wall of denial at the hospital. So if this cuts litigation and leaves patients feeling like they were treated in a more humane way, it's a terrific thing.
But on the other hand, I mean, I read actually the Associated Press reports that some doctors might resist the idea of paying for settlements after saying they're sorry if the patient wants the settlement because of a state law that allows consumers to view any malpractice findings against doctors. Could that dampen the effect of this new program, Jack?
Well, it could. Right now, what's reported are malpractice payments, not actually what the doctor what the error was. One of the things that the State Board of Registration has expressed in talking to the people who formulated this pilot program is a concern that there's not going to be that kind of transparency. So they still have to work it out. But I think one of the other parts of it is that doctors right now are the targets of the suits because of the charitable cap on litigation and liability, which is $20,000. So this is going to allow hospitals to step in and waive their cap and be involved in the offer settlement as well and take some of the pressure off doctors.
There is evidence that this has been working. The state of Michigan has actually done a lot of pilot programs on this to a great degree of success. Peter, last question to you on this, though. For a long, long time, people were calling for tort reform regarding medical malpractice. This is not that, but it might actually have the same effect in reducing the number of lawsuits.
I think everybody agrees that defensive medicine is a problem and it is a factor in increasing healthcare premiums. So, you know, if this takes some of the pressure off of doctors, it'll mean that there'll be fewer unnecessary tests ordered up, fewer sort of defensive decisions made by doctors that lead to unnecessary care and extra money for all of us. So I agree that it's a really good thing.
Well, let's move on now to our weekly hubbubs, and those are the stories that didn't make it quite above the fold or the top of the news. Anthony?
Yeah, so my hubbub it comes from my own hometown of Somerville, and it's about a new crackdown on bicyclists. I'm a biker, so this is of particular interest to me. Local police have stepped up enforcement of traffic laws in Somerville in a new bicycle enforcement operation. That means riders are being stopped and ticketed for blowing through stop signs and red lines. They're being red lights. They're being fined $20, $50 for providing a false name or false ID information. Now, of course, bikers should obey the rules of the road, but there's been some grumbling about this crackdown on the Somerville Patch, for example, about all of this. Police say this is all about making streets and sidewalks safer, not about collecting extra revenue, but the message, bikers, beware. And be safe, I guess, most importantly.
Peter Canellos, your hubbub.
This is a bit of investigative reporting that only very young people can do. The newspaper Teens in Print, which the Globe runs with the Boston Public Schools and Boston University's investigative journalism arm, sent teenagers out to pharmacies to ask for information about Plan B, which is the somewhat controversial morning after medication that the Health and Human Services Secretary ruled you needed a prescription for if you were under 17. So they just tested whether pharmacists understood the rules and in fact found that huge numbers of pharmacies in the Boston area do not. In fact, most of them were told that that they had to be 21. Any kid under 21 needed to have a prescription when, in fact, if you're between 17 and 21, you should be able to get the medicine over the counter. I think it, you know, raises questions about, given all the publicity, you know, how come the pharmacies are so far behind the curve? And the other issue is given that we rely on pharmacists for so many precise decisions about dosages and correct medication and things like that, shouldn't there be a mechanism to keep them ahead of the curve?
Hats off to those young reporters. Is this going to make its way into the Globe, actually? It
eventually,
sounds like a story.
Yes, it will.
Well, terrific. Jack Sullivan, your hubbub.
Mine's a little bit light, and it's somewhat tooting our own horn. A story I think most people, one of the all-time great pieces of political lore was former Massport and Congressman Peter Blute, when he had to step down after taking a daytime booze cruise back in 1999 because a woman by the name of Gidget Churchill flashed a photographer. Well, he's getting back into the political world slowly. He's the honorary executive director of the assistant deputy director of the state GOP. So I thought it was a good time to try to find Gidget Churchill, who has never spoken, and I was able to find her and looked a little bit deeper. And we've come to the conclusion, found some compelling evidence that Peter Blute was indeed set up by some potential political foes for this, although Gidget Churchill insists she was not part of it, says it was a momentary lapse in judgment. It's not real clear that she was not involved. But it's a pretty good read, and it's pretty interesting.
Wow. More great reporting from Commonwealth Magazine. My hubbub is also a light, but breaking today. Jose Canseco, who was at Fenway Park for the 100th anniversary celebrations, turns out he's going to be playing baseball again with none other than the Worcester Tornadoes. So there you
Fantastic.
Go. And apparently he's very active on Twitter, and his last tweet includes, "These guys are so lucky to be playing at Fenway." So Jose Canseco coming to Worcester. That's it for today's Week in Review. Jack Sullivan, senior investigative reporter for Commonwealth Magazine, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Peter Canellos, editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. Great to have you as always, Peter.
Thank you, Magna.
Stay with us. Coming up, Fenway Park celebrates its 100th anniversary, and we will share your favorite Fenway memory. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.